Talking Landscape Photography with Christian Fletcher and Carwin.
It is like-minded, and it's 2020, and it's great to be back. And we're going to kick off the new year with an aerial special. We sort of struggled with what to call it, and I came up with the idea of Masters of the Aerial Universe.
I like that.
Oh, Masters of the Aerial Universe. Well, what else did we... We had some other names. What were they?
Drone Dogs.
Drone Dogs, that's right, yeah. Was there another one?
Okay.
Plane, something like that? Plane Plonkers? Or plane, I can't remember.
Aerial assholes.
Well, this is a G-rated show, Carwin. We might have to up the rating, get the censors to do something about it.
We've got a very special guest today. She was born in Dalesford Base Hospital, was an English and a drama teacher in the Kimberley, then became a librarian. And somewhere along that path, she took a flight in a helicopter and fell in love with aerial photography and used to sell her work at a market stall on Saturday mornings. Besides that, Mika Boynton, is there anything we don't know about you?
Yep. I used to be a rower as well, and I did surf boat rowing and bobsleigh, competed for Australia, yeah. A few other bits and pieces. But you did great research, Carwin.
Yeah, that's amazing. Actually, that was one thing. I think we've spoken about this before in the past, that you were actually on the Australian women's bobsled team for the Olympics. And I just thought that's the kind of the weirdest thing to, and I just keep thinking about that movie Cool Runnings. And that's all I can think about when I think about you and bobsledding.
It kind of actually was like that. We did go over with a coach, and then somewhere along the line the coach became part of the men's team, so we ended up without a coach. So there were three of us in the women's team traveling all around Europe and North America, and competing and making up our own itinerary and booking our own accommodation and driving around with a van with the bobsleigh in the back. It was very cool runnings.
Yeah, it's incredible. Now, I've just got a question for Carwin. Are you still there, mate?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, yeah, we just can't see you anymore.
Hey, do you know what I was doing while you guys were having a chat? I just I found some music here. Fletch, you were around in the awesome 80s, is that right?
I was, mate, I was.
Do you remember a rock and roll musician by the name of Billy Idol?
Yeah.
Do you realise he wrote a song about you?
No, what did he write?
Have a listen to this.
Fletch.
There you go, mate. Just found that.
Fletch for fantasy.
I reckon we should put that in the show intro. What do you reckon?
Yeah, that's not bad, mate. It's not bad.
Fletch.
That's actually supposed to be flesh, I'm sure. But look, our audience is a bit younger than that, and Mika's way younger than that.
No. You know what? I actually think that was Choose 88, because I reckon that's the first cassette I ever bought, and I think that song was on that cassette.
Is that right? So you would have been like a baby.
Yeah, I was little.
Carwin and I, we were in our late 30s probably in those days. But
Yeah.
No, actually, no, we were little. We were.
Yeah, I'm not that much younger.
Yeah. Hey, look, you are an amazing person, and we've crossed paths several times. You're a what I would call a high achiever. Now, you were granted a scholarship to do a rowing thing. What would you call it? A rowing study? Rowing study? Do you study to be a rower in a university of California? So, and then I think you challenged me to a foot race at Carrageenie.
Yes! Oh, my gosh. Yes, that was crazy. That was insane. That was very silly. We ran up out of Weino Gorge, and I honestly can't remember who won, but I remember that I was absolutely wrecked, because if anyone's walked down into Weino Gorge, you have to be really careful walking down. Running up is so stupid.
Yeah.
Did this actually happen? Like, seriously, you guys had a foot race?
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
And, sprint, like full on, as hard as we could go up those very narrow steps with camera gear. No, I think we left the camera gear.
Yeah, I think something like that. But I think you said, look, if I beat you to the top, I'm going to be the best photographer in the world one day. And that was the title that I wanted. So I think we raced and raced and raced, and I wasn't going to give up. But where does that drive come from?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I was a very quiet little girl, and I think quiet little girls tend to be I don't know. I tend to do a lot of inner stuff rather than outer stuff, and I think I've just always been determined and stubborn a little bit. And I've got parents who set great examples and are all about setting goals and achieving them. And I guess I don't know. It's just always been there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's definitely obvious, I think, from day one. That you, I remember you coming to Karajini on a workshop and bringing your whole computer with you. And I think that was the first time we'd actually ever seen that someone actually, you know, most people turn up with laptops and you turned up with a whole computer with screen and keyboard.
Well,
and...
I have to set you straight on that, though. It was only because I couldn't get hold of a laptop. I didn't own one and no one would loan me one, and there was no shop in Derby to borrow one. So my only option was to pack up my whole PC and drive the 10 hours from Derby to the Karajini with the PC in the back of the car on those dirt gravel roads and set it up. But the beautiful thing was, because I had my PC, I needed two PowerPoints, one for the screen and one for the computer. So I got the best seat in the house.
You did. You got the air conditioning, I believe.
Something like that. But it was good light and yeah. Yep.
Wonder what the internet was like. Yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think what...
No internet, isn't... I don't think there is internet.
Oh, that's just like today. But, wow, there you go.
Yeah, you could get a bit of a signal on your phone if you walked to the start of the track where you go into the eco retreat at Karajini, and if you stood on an anthill and faced towards the, you know, Tom Price, I think you could pick up one bar and you could try and get a text message out. Help, help. I need help. I've got an overachieving photographer, bobsled team member.
Yeah, no. But I also want to interrupt and tell you that I was very mistaken. I actually did think I was okay at photography, and I was terrible. I was so clueless and so green, and everyone else but me knew it.
Can I ask you this, Mika? When did you realise that you actually, you know, were a good photographer? Like, I mean, properly. Like, where did the confidence come to go pro? You were selling your shots at a market stall, and like, you gave your job away to become a photographer full time. But where did you get to the point where you just thought, yeah, I can take good photos? When did that come?
I think all artists have a bit of self doubt. For me, I'm still hoping that I'm going to make this work. It's a big deal to give up your full-time job and follow your passion. And what happened with me was actually that I was working full-time managing the library services for TAFE in the Kimberley, and I was doing the market stall, which meant that every Saturday I was there from 5:30 till... I didn't get home till 3, and then every evening I was packaging and ordering and printing, and it was all too much, actually. I was working 7 days a week and all evenings and all the rest of it. And then in their wisdom, the state government was tightening the belt, and many jobs were going, and voluntary redundancy came on the table, and my staff advised me that they, in my best interest, and this is genuine, that they thought it was about time that I pursued my photography and accepted the golden handshake. And so I did. I put my hand up, and that gave me just over 6 months.
Sure, I thought you were going to say 6 million.
No, oh my gosh, that would have been amazing.
It would never be nice.
No, but I think it was. It had got to the point, breaking point. I could either sideline the photography or jump fully into the photography, and now I've jumped fully into the photography, and I can't even tell you, I love it. I love every minute of it, and yeah, as long as you're not too specific about the exact things that you want to do, like, for example, I would love to just do landscapes. I'm not really very good at people photography. Well, I won't say that. I don't really enjoy people photography because I don't like having my photo taken, so I don't like subjecting other people to the same thing. But I've photographed events and architecture and, you know, all of that stuff in the past year. But yeah, my passion obviously absolutely is landscape photography and aerial photography. It is very different, but it's aerial photography makes my heart sing because it's all of that. Because my background, actually, I did a lot of art, loved art all the way through high school, uni, all the rest of it. And my inspiration in terms of photography, they're actually artists, painting artists rather than photographer artists. And so when I discovered aerial photography, which was actually on a workshop with Fletch at Home Valley Station, the first time I flew and just saw the shapes and patterns underneath me and saw nature's abstract art, I just was like, this is it. You know, this is incredible. Wow. This is everything. This is, you know, my love of nature, my love of beautiful things, all of the stuff about composition and form and shape and pattern and texture, all of it is right there. And actually, I only got one shot on that flight that was worth keeping, but it did go on to win a lot of awards. Yeah. But that's not the point. I only got one shot and I was like, nah, I want to make this work and I've got to learn a lot more about aerial photography because it is a whole, it's a specific genre. It's very specific skill set and you really need to know your camera. You need to know what the limitations are of your equipment and of the vehicle and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, anyway, that's a long answer to a short question.
Yeah, look, you talk about awards. Now you're the current winner of the 2019 Pano Awards and also the 2019 AIPP Victorian Landscape Photographer of the Year. So you know, when did you start becoming so awesome and how did you start doing these things and winning these? Because you've got the golden touch. You enter these things and you win lots. So how did that happen? What was you talk about your first aerial photographs that you took, but what was the process from there? I mean, you did Home Valley, but then you've moved on and you've done so much more. Just tell us a bit more about that background of how you started to get these award winning images.
I think a lot of it is practice. A lot of it is having people like you whose work, you know, you aspire to. I was very reluctant to enter Australian-based competitions for a long time because I am fearful of making mistakes in front of people, and I guess that comes from being the quiet little girl. I don't like my failures to be spectacular and in front of everybody. So I actually joined the Australian Photographic Society and through them I started working towards my honours with the International Federation of Art Photography, FIAP, or if you want to say it in French, Fédération de l'Art Photographique.
I'll have a crack at and, that. Actually, no.
And their honours system is based on acceptances in international exhibitions, and as you grow through the ranking, then it becomes about awards. And what that does is, out of the limelight, in the background where no one else was noticing, I was just testing myself. And the other great thing about entering these exhibitions is you receive a catalogue of images, all the award-winning images. And so I surrounded myself by these insanely good images and just immersed myself in that and tried to improve my work. And I don't think there's a simple answer to that, Christian. It's just you have to practice, you have to put in the hard yards. It doesn't just happen. You know that as well as everyone. You need to know your equipment so that when the opportunity presents itself, you're in a position to capture that. I've been very fortunate when I was managing the library services for TAFE in the Kimberley, I would put together all my holidays and go away. So I went on Ignacio Palacios's trip to Patagonia and I went to Hogard Milan's trip to Namibia. So I saw these spectacular places and, I have a bit of a thing about listening to the landscape. I say that I listen to the landscape and that is my way of saying that you immerse yourself in the moment rather than trying to inflict your idea of what should happen on the landscape. And I think the landscape rewards you for that. And so being in these incredible places and just being in that moment and feeling it, the atmosphere, and I think that helps you to be able to capture the beauty and majesty of those places, even when the weather's not, you know, perfect.
Wonderful. Yeah.
When you're shooting in those sort of conditions, do you have a plan, or is it just, are you shooting from the soul, like you're just shooting what's in front of you?
I do a lot of research before I go anywhere, and then when I get there, so like I, for example, in Broome, if you're doing aerial photography, you need to know when low tide is, you need to know where, you know, what time sunrise is, you need to know, you know, the direction of the sun, all that kind of stuff. But once you get there, then let it all go. You're there, you can't change any of that. Whatever research you did got you there. And then it's just up to that moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I agree totally. Now, you've also had some other friends to go taking aerials with. Another great photography artist is Tanya Malkin.
Yes.
And she's a good friend, and she's an amazing photographer. She's done some beautiful aerials as well. So have you spent much time out there with her doing that sort of stuff?
Yeah, she's actually taught me pretty much everything I know apart from what you taught me at that workshop. Tanya is an incredible aerial photographer and technically outstanding. And so we would often talk for hours and hours about settings, about locations. She and I have done, I'd say, over half of the aerial shoots that I've done have been with Tanya. So she was living in Kununurra, I was living in Broome. I'd go to Kununurra, we'd do the East Kimberley. She'd come to Broome, we'd do Roebuck Bay. We've also travelled to Iceland. So in 2017, we went to Iceland to photograph the Braided Rivers, which was an absolute highlight. There's nothing like the Braided Rivers of Iceland. But yeah, we shoot together a lot, and it's great to have someone that you can pitch ideas off or come up with plans, you know, work together instead of just feeling like you're working in a vacuum.
Yeah, and it's good that you have that connection, because you know, quite often in the past we've done podcasts, one recently with Erin Babnick, and we talked about girls in landscape photography and security and, you know, feeling comfortable and all that sort of stuff. And having Tanya to go out shooting with, I'm sure that kind of helps with the, you know, not, you know, I don't know what sort of person I'm a bit of a scaredy cat. When I'm on my own, it's always someone, especially if you're remote and look, a lot of the places where you go, living up in the Kimberley, I'm sure you probably got used to it, but it's always nice to have that security.
It is. And also, and Erin, because I did listen to her initial podcast with you guys, sorry, your podcast with her, and she mentioned about, you know, doing stuff in groups and having a group of people to work with, and how, you know, as a girl, it can be a bit difficult, because if you go traveling, and a lot of this stuff, you go camping. So, you know, the Kimberley, you don't just stay in a hotel, you know, you go and you camp. And if you're two girls or two guys, that's really easy. You can share a tent, share accommodation or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you've got a person of a different gender and that person's married, for example, that can cause a bit of uncertainty. So... it's just easier to, and look, there's, you know, it's no one's fault. And, you know, like, I guess the other thing, we were talking a few days ago, I came to visit you in Dunsborough, and I mentioned about, you know, but people did make a bit of a big deal about me winning the Pano Awards as the first woman to win. And I was more excited about being the first Australian to win. And I think, you know, that kind of highlights the situation at the moment, where I don't want to be a girl photographer. I don't want my work to be judged in a lens of being female photography. it's very important for me that my photography is my photography, full stop. And I benefit from living in my generation where I can be 40 years old and single and not be called an old maid. I can be in the prime of my life and taking photographs and spending selfishly my life doing what I love doing. And, you know, this wasn't possible if I'd been born 20 years earlier. You know, societal pressure was so different. You know, the opportunities just weren't there. And also the camera gear. Like, this is really the first time that it's been possible to go up in a helicopter that you pay for to take you and, you know, to do this. It's just not been possible before now.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you on that, your preferred method of aerial photography is the helicopter?
Yes.
That's expensive.
And secondary plane. It is. But I heard Tony say recently that the reason he does it is because of that kinesthetic connection with the camera, and that you're actually seeing with your own eyes what you're photographing and the context that it's in. And I absolutely agree with that. I just feel that as an artist, you're trying to convey emotion through a two-dimensional, you know, very flat image. You know, you're trying to imbue that with emotion, because ultimately it's an emotional response you want from your viewer. And from my point of view, if there's no emotion in the first place, how can you convey emotion? So for me, when I'm up there and I'm flying, I am the most joyous ever. Like, it is so much fun, so brilliant.
That is true, and it is that emotional thing about being up in a plane and photographing out a window. And I believe Carwin does it all the time. He likes to shoot from his corporate jet. Do you ever shot from a corporate jet?
Only when I'm traveling with Sir Peter Eastway, we get around by a corporate jet. And it's to reduce my carbon footprint, because let's face it, it slashes your wait time at the airport, so that's got to be good for the environment somehow.
I'd be interested from you though, Christian, because you do a lot of drone photography. Do you notice the difference?
Definitely in the file quality, yes. Because if you're talking about just the technical side of it, definitely shooting out of a plane with a good camera is way better than shooting with a drone. But I do love the drone, only because it saved me tens of thousands of dollars. In fact, I probably could have bought my own Cessna for the money I've saved on flying my drone. But I really get what you say about having that connection, and I didn't really think about it too much until you talked about it, because, you know, I go up with the drone, you know, I'm flying around and I don't really get excited about it. I don't have this feeling of awe and I'm doing something different. I'm just putting a drone up in the air. I'm looking at my iPad and I get some great photos, but there is not that same feeling you get from being, you know, tossed around in an aeroplane.
I still get nervous every time that I'm sitting on the runway. I still, it doesn't matter how many times I've flown, I still get that little frisson as I'm about to go up in the air. And I get excited.
How do you deal with the pressure? Because, I mean, look, a helicopter's, you know, at least $1,500 an hour.
I've managed to get a few cheaper flights than that, I have to say.
Really?
But it's certainly you, so understanding what your camera can do for you is key. So to those who asked you questions about aerial photography, this is the bit that they want to hear. With my Nikon DSLR, I can set up my camera so that it is auto ISO sensitivity, meaning it will work between certain parameters. I can set that up so that my camera will only shoot a photo if it's a... So I set a maximum ISO of 3200 and a minimum shutter speed of 1/1000th. And because I put it on aperture priority, as long as it's relatively flat, f5.6 is perfectly sufficient. Because you've got no mountains, is all, you know, f5.6 is enough depth of field. So you have to, in order for that to work, your focus point needs to be in the center of the shot. So f5.6, focus point in the center of the shot, auto ISO sensitivity with a minimum shutter speed of 1/1000th, and I have manual focus prime lenses. My favorite one is the Zeiss 100mm. And what that means is I know that my shots are sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is so all I have to do is get the composition right.
Yeah, yeah, which is, that's what you want to do. You want to eliminate that, any doubt. You don't want to be fiddling around with dials and stuff while you're out, once you're in the air. You really want to get that nailed. And I think that's a great workflow that you're doing, because invariably, every time I go up in a plane, I panic. It's like, oh my God, the meter's running.
There's a lot of pressure to get it right, isn't there? You know.
Well,
there's a lot of pressure to get it right. Like you can't. You know, if you have a bad hour, it's, you know, it's cost money.
Yeah, yeah, and you freak out. I literally get on the plane, and it takes me, I don't know if it's the same with you, Mika, but like I need 10 minutes just to relax and not even, you know, push the button, because, well, I mean, I'm pushing the button, but I probably need 10 minutes to relax, but I don't, because you just freak out and you go, I've got to start shooting. And I think that's the first thing that goes through people's minds when they get in the air. You've got to be a bit more relaxed and just think about it. And look, if there is something that's beautiful that you want to photograph, you just tell the pilot to turn around and orbit over that a couple of times.
Well, this is the reason that I prefer helicopters, is because it's much easier for a helicopter to go around and get a second go at something than a plane. Having said that, I had the most amazing flight at Gutaragutta Shark Bay 2 years ago. I was with a guy, a pilot named Joe with Shark Bay Aviation. And when I admitted to him that I'd really would have preferred to go up in a helicopter, ooh, I think he made it his personal mission to make my flight as helicopter-like as possible. And he was, you guys can't see me, but I'll show you, Carson and Cohen and Christian. It was like this. I'm not joking. It was like, he was I was able to shoot straight down, which is the other reason that I prefer a helicopter, because I really like my photos to be abstract.
That was one of my questions too, is do you enjoy that abstract nature more than literal scenes, or do you still shoot a literal aerial scene, like including a bit of the horizon, or
pretty much aerials are abstract and landscapes are literal. For me, it's that division. So aerials, I don't want people to see what it is that I'm shooting. I want them to look at it as an abstract piece. If there's a little bird to show the sense of scale, or if there's a stick or something that gives it away, fine. But if I can avoid that, I do. I just want it to be about shapes, patterns, colors, textures, patterns, lines. Just those combinations are what make it beautiful to me. Having said that, I think the most successful aerials are ones where you can see something in it that reminds you of something else. So the symbolism and metaphor of abstracts is what I'm really looking for. So I don't know if you did see the photo that won the Pano Awards, but there's a dragon. There's a fire-breathing dragon in that photo.
Rorschach test. Do you ever get up there? I mean, you have an image in your mind about what you want to get, but do you ever get up there and you're just totally blown away with what's in front of you and your plan changes?
No, I always, just as I said, I do my planning. I look on Google Earth. Google Earth is a great resource for planning your flights. I'll pick out things that look interesting, either, you know, where you can see that. Okay, classic example. Let me finish my sentence and then I'll go to that. So I do all of that research, and then as soon as I'm up in the air, it's literally what I'm seeing. I no longer have that plan in my head. It's gone. I'm responding to what I'm seeing through the viewfinder. So as I said, an example, I just recently drove across the Nullarbor. I was very lucky to get across. And I did a shoot over Lake Lefroy, which is a fantastic area just south of Kalgoorlie. It's a salt lake and there's a fair bit of mining activity. Now, I had looked at that on Google Earth and it was dry as a bone. So what I thought would be interesting is where the drainage happens into the lake. So you can see that there's like tree-like patterns, you know, and I like that kind of stuff. I was completely going to ignore all of the man-made structures and, you know, focus on the natural stuff. As soon as I got up in the air, I realized because it had been raining, all those areas were just mud, not particularly exciting. And all of the interesting areas were actually around the mining stuff, so the tailings dams and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, my original plan out the window. We just decided, and I said to the pilot, you know, I'll just tell you where to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true. You do, once you get in the air, it's a little bit the same with the drone. Sometimes you'll get to a, you know, you look at that scene on Google Earth, and it'll be taken at a certain time. I do a lot of Salt Lake stuff up in the Midwest, and sometimes it looks completely dry, and then you get there and you find that it's full of water. So, yeah, the plans do change. Now, look, we got some questions in from Amy Smith, and one thing that she really wanted to ask was, you know, how do you find a good pilot when you want to achieve a certain look? Did you know that these pilots that you were using had done aerial photography before, or did you just have to tune them in and tell them what you wanted?
So up until recently, all the pilots that I'd had, as soon as I identified myself as being a photographer and showed them my work and said, this is what I want to achieve, and you can see very clearly with my work that it's directly overhead, most plane companies will assign you an appropriate pilot. But just recently, I had a different experience, and it's really important that you talk to the pilot beforehand, find out how much work they've done in this area, because they may not understand. Like, the crucial understanding, I think, is the shooting straight down. If you want to shoot straight down, it does take a certain kind of flying, a style of flying that most pilots don't ordinarily do. You know, they're used to flying across, not, you know, not on an angle. So being able to spend at least 10 minutes with the pilot before you fly to explain what you're looking for, show them the pictures of the style of photographs that you want to take so that the pilot has an idea, so that they've got it in their head, this is the kind of stuff that this person's looking for, that will save you a lot of disappointment. Because otherwise, you know, once you're up in the air, it can be really difficult. Your pilot's responsible for keeping the plane in the air, and you don't want to interrupt that too much.
Yeah. Now, would that be the same for your international flights? So when you went to Iceland, had you heard about a pilot or a particular airline or that was flying in a certain region, or did you just Google them, or how did you find them?
Yeah, so Tanya and I did the planning for that together. We located the area that we wanted to shoot on Google Earth. Then we did a bit of research for the nearest nearest flight strip. We found the company, we approached them, we said, do you do aerial photography flights? They said, yes, we've got a very experienced pilot. And it turned out that, yes, our pilot was very experienced.
Yeah.
Just got another question in here too. This is from Philip S. Which is the most photogenic country you've ever traveled to and why? Would it be Iceland?
In terms of aerials or just in general?
I guess in general.
Oh, that's really tough.
Yeah, it's a hard one, isn't it?
My favourite countries for aerial photography. Look, honestly, like the Iceland braided rivers, you could shoot that every day of your life and not grow tired of it. It's absolutely mind-blowing. Mm. But in terms of variety, Western Australia is the best.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, you've got all that coast, all of those salt lakes inland. We're so lucky. And I'm sure I've heard Tony say, you know, we have some of the best aerial photographers in the world in Australia. And it's because we have those places accessible to us. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. The Kimberley, the Pilbara, that whole Coral Coast area, we're so lucky.
Yeah.
So yes, yeah. I mean Iceland because it just blows your head, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, actually it's funny you should say that about WA, because I just had a couple of other really excellent aerial photographers come through to the gallery just the other day, Paul Holland and Scott McCook, and these guys are diehard plane helicopter fans, but they've both recently just got drones.
Oh, dear. Oh really?
Shock horror scandal. So yes, I'm mentioning, I'm outing them on this podcast, and they were just down doing some stuff over the Salt Lakes in the southwest here, and you're right, WA is crazy for aerials. And I remember an English mate who's done a lot of Iceland aerials saying, I showed him some stuff, some of the Salt Lakes north of Esperance, and he was frothing, going, oh, my, have you actually photographed these yet? I said, oh, no, I haven't done them yet. I'll get out there soon. he could not believe that I was not frothing and racing out. And interestingly enough, one of my favourite aerial photographs that I ever took was shot at the Dunsborough rubbish tip. So, you know, it's only about five k's from home. Yeah, it was a little tailings dam
thing.
Yeah,
that was amazing, that thing. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, I got some of my really favourite aerials just from processing facilities and industrial sites and tailings dams just around home. Mm. And, you know, I live in the pristine part of Australia, but it's still surrounded by mining and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, and when these tailings dams don't look like a horrible pit of toxic waste but look like a beautiful abstract painting, then that's what I'm looking for, and I'm sure that's what you look for as well. So, yeah, WA's got it all. It really has. It's just incredible.
Mm. Yeah, very lucky. And there are so many, you know, when you said about asking, doing an aerial podcast, I actually came up with a huge list, and Instagram wouldn't let me post more than, I wasn't allowed to tag more than 10 photographers, and I had to leave a stack off. But there's, WA's got so many incredible aerial photographers. But yeah, as you said, Paul, also amazing work.
Yeah.
Just on that, look, there are a lot of aerial photographers now, but look, just one question for you. Who's your favourite photographer ever? Favourite aerial photographer?
Oh. Do you know, I would have to say the work of Andrei Ermolov, who was the first photographer that I'd seen photograph the braided rivers of Iceland. Mm. I was blown away by his work. I saw it first on 500 pics. But if you, yeah, I can't remember how to spell his name, but his work just blew my head. I really appreciate Richard Waldendorp's work. Mm. And I'm amazed at how he managed to do that with film cameras. That just does my head in. But yeah, look, I think that was when I first got into it. Now, look, we're just so spoilt for choice. There's so many incredible aerial photographers now who are just doing amazing stuff. Mm. I mean, look, there's the team who did the I've just gone blank. Ignacio and Luke and Ricardo and
the
Paul,
Light Collective.
What are they called?
The Light Collective.
Gone totally blank. they're two projects at Caditanda Lake Air and up in Queensland are pretty spectacular. But yeah, look, we there's just so many. Ty Stedman, I recently caught up with him, and he's done these amazing aerials of people skiing. Just, yeah, I could go on and on, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Where to now for the genre? Do you think it's, you know, where's it going to progress to?
It's interesting because some people say to me it's a gimmick and it's a passing fad and all the rest of it, but I disagree. I think that you can't really generalise all of aerial photography together. I mean, mine is very abstract, but not everyone does completely abstract work. I've also heard it said about photography in general. You know, everyone can take photos now. Why bother? You know, that everyone's a photographer these days. And I'm like, okay, let's compare that to writing. Everyone can write, right? Everyone can write a story. Does that mean that the most amazing writers don't stand out, because they do. They have a voice. Mm. It's all about the voice. It's how you see. And when people get a bit jaded, or they, you know, feel like there's so many photographers and they're feeling like, you know, why bother, or they're losing their FOJO, I call it FOJO. I say to those people, I'm like, but your voice is unique. Your eye is unique. No one else sees like you. Ignore all that clutter. Let it go. Get it out of your head. Just do what you makes you happy, and other people will recognize it. You know, like, if you have a strong voice, people will see it. You know that, you recognize it. It's like an incredible writer. You read an incredible book and you're like, wow, wow. Same with incredible photography. You see it and you just know, wow, this person knows. They have a vision. They're clear. They know their style.
Yeah, that's. I think that's probably one of the best things I've heard explaining why people should not give up, and why people should pursue the passion and do their aerials and do their other things, and not worry about so many people doing it also. Because, like you said, I mean, the cream will rise to the top, and it always does. And when digital came out, I know people were saying, oh, it makes it so easy. Everyone's a photographer these days. But yes, true. It's just raised the standard of photography. But the people that have the best eye and the best ideas and the most passion will rise to the top. And it's the same. You look at sport and how look at bobsledding, for instance. You know, if you go back to when it first started, you know, with a, you know, little homemade cart made out of wood and a couple of screws, and to what they've got today with these amazing slick looking machines, and then they come running down, they got special skis, and they got their suits and their helmets and all. You know, it's the nth degree, and we just continue to increase that level of quality
and it's exciting.
Yeah,
it's exciting. You know, like the fact that there's so many photographers and it's opening up people's minds to try different things and new things, and to you know, the opportunities we have now because of the technology that's available. That's exciting.
Yeah, and look, I want to use this opportunity to plug Carwin's new book. It's photographs from the window of business class in every airline around the world.
That's the only way. I mean, you peasants, you know, you take your photos from your helicopters. I mean, you know, it's the only way to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, he does it with a glass of champagne in one hand and a camera in the other. And I've seen the work; it's exquisite. Okay, sure, he gets the side of the bulkhead of the plane every now and then,
that's
and
part of the composition.
The overhead lockers, and a few shots of the floor, and his meal, you know, his roast pheasant under glass sort of meals and stuff. But look, I think it's going to be a great book, and I think it's going to be one for the masses. Carwin, congratulations on that.
Thank you. Look, can I just say today, you may or may not be aware of this, but we are recording today on Wednesday, the 8th of January. Mika is in Victoria, and the reason we wanted to get her in today was because, you know, it's a fairly perilous situation over there with the bushfires. Mika, how are you getting on right now? Like, it's all very, very recent for you, isn't it?
It's actually been a really lovely distraction up until right this second to be doing this podcast. No, it's really scary times. It's all very theoretical until you know someone, or it's your house that's in danger, or, you know someone who's lost things in the bushfires. It's scary. I'm very fortunate. I know my house is safe. The fires have not made it to Bright yet, but Northeast Victoria is one of the most special places in Australia, in my opinion. And I know you shot there, Christian. It's an absolutely beautiful town, and it's right in the foothills of the mountains. They are beautiful Victorian high country, and the high country is burning. And Australian landscape is used to fire. This is a fact. Not all. Definitely there are areas that date back to Gondwana that have not seen fire and rainforests, and, you know, they aren't supposed to burn, and they are burning. But there is also a huge number of ecosystems that rely on fire, but this is unprecedented. This is this is really scary. And I'm not a very political person, but I do hope those who are in charge of the custodianship of our country from a political point of view, I hope that they're really trying to find ways that we can preserve our beautiful country for the future, because they are all saying that this is the new normal, and that's awful. That's a horrible thing to have to contemplate.
It is, yeah. And it is. It's a horrible time, and who would have thought, I mean, a year ago, you know, we've had some terrible fires that have been through Victoria and New South Wales in the past, and WA, of course. But who would have thought that there could be anything like this, fires that you can't put out?
Or Tasmania. I mean, the dry fires last year in Tassie, that's burning areas that will never regenerate the same. That's gone.
Yeah, and I think as landscape photographers, we derive a lot of inspiration from the Australian bush and the landscape, and it's just tragic to see that go. It's hard to fathom. But look, that's a bit of a sad note to end on. But the good thing is we've got you in the photography world. We've got your work, your beautiful images, and your great smile. You're always smiling and always happy and laughing, and we love that. And we love the fact that you're a go-getter. And you said to me way back when at Karajini that you watch Christian. I'm going to be one of the best photographers.
Was that after she kicked your butt in the photos?
And look, here you are. You're doing it. So I think that's great. And it's a lesson to all of us that you can do whatever you want if you have that passion and drive. And I mean, and literally you can do anything. And you're a classic example of that. So we want to thank you for being on the podcast.
Before you go, look, if people want to buy your work, and they absolutely should, because it's some of the best aerial stuff I've ever seen, how can they do that, Mika?
Best place is my website, www.mikaboynton.com. If you like following along with social media stuff, my tag on both Facebook and Instagram is Mika Boynton Photography. You guys have pumped my head way too big. I'm not going to be able to walk out the door from here.
That's okay.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you both. And yeah, it has been a very pleasant distraction from the real world for a little bit.
Yeah, we don't live in the real world, Carmen and I.
No.
Yeah, he's in the business class world. The private jet world. and you mentioned earlier something about camping up in the Kimberley, you know, sleeping in tents and all that
In tents. What?
Yeah, and Carmen lives by the, you know, he doesn't want to sleep under the stars. He just wants to sleep under five stars. That's all he wants.
Just to qualify what Fletcher's saying, that is absolutely not true. And I've flown business class once in my life, and that's it.
Talking about the camping in the Kimberley, in the next couple of years, I hope to take people up to the Kimberley, because obviously I lived there for 10 years and I look forward to doing tours there. And Tanya and I are also talking about running some aerial workshops. So watch this space.
Actually, that's...
I'd love to take people with me and show them what I love most.
If you're paying, Carmen and I are in.
Yeah. I'll be all over that. Mika, have you got any workshops coming up?
My New Year's resolution was to sink my teeth into setting some dates, but obviously my new year has been a little up in the air. But I expect to be able to release dates within... as long as I can concentrate over the next few weeks, I'll be releasing that. And I'm also excited to announce the new news is that I've just joined up with the Nikon School, and I'll be teaching people introduction to the DSLR and intermediate DSLR. So that's all exciting. But I don't have any dates for you right this second, but it's soon, very soon.
Excellent. Yeah. Fantastic, Mika. Well, thank you for being on. Lovely chatting with you, and hopefully people will get over to your website, look at your work, buy some stuff, and good luck with all your workshops going forward and all your work and all your shooting, and hope to see you back over in WA again soon.
I hope so too, Christian. It was great to catch up and lovely to meet you, Carwin.
Likewise. Thanks, Mika. That was part one of our aerial special. Next week, we're going to be catching up with the aerial mastermind himself, Mr. Tony Hewitt. So we'll see you then. Bye.